At Market District, we believe in the power of great taste. So here's a little taste of all the delicious possibilities. Juicy, hand-picked heirloom tomatoes. Seared certified Angus steak over aged cheddar mashed potatoes. Or how about fresh dough, stretched by hand for every house-made pizza? Is your mouth watering yet? From produce to meats to chef-made meals, discover great taste at Market District.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast, this week coming to you live from the Royal Institution in London! My name is Dan Schreiber. I am sitting here with Anna Tashinsky, Andrew Hunter-Murray, and James Harkin. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is Andy.
My fact is, the first ever megawatt-scale wind turbine was erected at a Vermont mountain called Grandpa's Knob.
Okay.
So this is a wind turbine, and it's a megawatt scale. You know, it could generate a megawatt of electricity at any one time. That was the capacity. We're in 1941, October 1941, just before Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. Coincidence?
So yes. America had nothing to do at that time, I guess.
I know, it was easy breezy times, but no, that's just setting the scene for you. And there was a guy called Palmer Putnam, who was both a sailor and an engineer. He lived very near Grandpa's Knob, Cape Cod, and he had two problems. One was constantly windy, just constantly the wind blowing in off the Atlantic, just constant. Secondly, his electricity bills were too high. And he thought, I wonder if I could combine these problems into one solution. And he had a bit of expertise in the field, and he built this wind turbine. It lasted about, not very long, sadly, about 2 years. But it was groundbreaking because there had been turbines before. They could generate electricity, but this was the biggest that had ever been built. You know, a megawatt is sort of a symbolic threshold, I guess, to get over.
It only lasted 2 years because it got blown over.
Yes.
Did it?
Which I think is sometimes a problem with wind turbines, isn't it?
Occasionally, yeah. Yeah, you do need to build them to withstand that.
I know in Denmark, if it gets too windy, they turn off.
That's true. That kind of if it's sort of very stormy conditions.
But this guy was like, he was really famous in his time, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I read that he did a lecture at NASA about wind power, and then he signed autographs for 45 minutes afterwards.
Really?
And that's because they all thought he was going to be like the Edison of wind power, and they thought wind power is going to be the next big thing, so we're going to get his autograph fast.
Wow. Amazing. I should say how important this was because a megawatt, it was 10 times bigger than the biggest windmill that had ever been produced in terms of the electricity it could generate.
Right.
And in fact, most people had windmills at the time that were about 1,000th of this scale in generation.
Because basically, like those little ones that you stick in your garden on a little pole.
Exactly like that. Yeah. Farmers had them. For grinding corn and for other boring, mm-hmm. you know,
if you
tasks.
Go even now to like the Midwest of America, like in old movies and stuff, you see them. They're like bits of metal with tiny windmills on.
Yeah, they're sort of like ugly versions of European windmills, aren't they? They're like disproportionate with a tiny head and a massive body.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. But the thing is, like, because they were pioneers going out west, mm-hmm. they had to make do with what they had. They couldn't just get loads and loads of planks and make an enormous, beautiful windmill. Mm-hmm. They had to just make it as minimalistic as possible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think it's quite ironic that kind of America was built on those windmills, but now the right wing in America just hates wind farms.
That's true. That's true. And after Putnam built this, this was 41. It took until really the 1970s for wind to take off in a big way, which was partly thanks to the oil crisis, two oil crises in the 70s.
Right.
When there was a, you know, cut off of fuel from the Middle East. Yeah. But those problems.
those days were
resolved. So we don't need to worry about that.
I just wanted to ask the question on everyone's lips, the most important question about this. Who's grandpa?
Well.
And can we be introduced? No.
I don't think I found why it was called Grandpa's Knob. I did look.
No, I don't think anyone knows unless someone around here has found it.
No.
But there is next to it another place called Biddy Knob. And it seems like maybe Grandpa, because Biddy, it's short for Bridget, but it was also used in America in those days to mean like an old lady. So it might have been that Grandpa Nob and Biddy Nob together made a couple, and they might have been named after two people from the area.
Hey, Andy, is there, I think the other main question that listeners of our show want to know, is there a society to do with wind turbines and windmills, and have you joined?
I haven't found one yet, but I don't think there's a Grandpa's Knob Preservation Society, because it got taken, as you said, James, it got blown over and damaged in a storm. And then a few years ago, someone proposed putting up a modern turbine, kind of the same size, as a tribute to this amazing engineering first. And someone else said, oh, what if it vibrates? And so they cancelled the plan.
Okay.
So they've got but they have got a phone mast there now. So, you know, that's...
That's something, isn't it?
Progress of sorts, isn't it?
Yeah. One more thing on Palmer Putnam. He also designed amphibious landing craft used during the Normandy landings.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, he's a big deal. And later in life, he got into gardening, and he always planted vegetables next to each other that he knew would grow to the exact same height.
What?
One of those inventions is more useful than the other, I'd say.
So they're really big now, aren't they? They're even bigger than the Grandpa's Knob.
Yeah, way bigger. Yeah.
Wind turbines.
Wind turbines, right. Yes. And in fact, the biggest wind turbine in the world is currently being built in Germany. It's going to be 360 meters high, which is 100 stories high, which is quite cool and difficult because cranes can only get up to about half that height. So you build half of it. They are currently building half of it with cranes. And then the other half is just telescoped on the inside. So you get to halfway up, and then you pull the rest out like a telescope. Yeah, I don't know if it's as simple as that, construction-wise, but it's essentially it. The other half is inside.
That's so cool.
It's clever.
I've been reading about windmills, old school.
Oh, yeah?
Fascinating. Fascinating history. I didn't realize there was a code of the windmills. So you would do social announcements via your windmill.
No.
Yeah, so I've printed out this thing. So you can probably have a go at guessing, but okay. So you never used to leave your windmill with the... So if you had four sails, you would never leave it with the vertical right up.
Can I say why?
Yes.
Because the vertical one going down would stop you getting out the door.
No, I mean, probably correct, but what it really was back in the day, it was lightning bolts. You would have the highest thing, and so it would attract lightning bolts.
Yeah.
You can leave it there like that now because they have rods that attract the lightning in its place. But that used to be a way that people, if they saw that the windmill sail was up like that, it meant, okay, they're not at home, but they'll be back because no fool would leave their sail fully vertical.
Oh, so, wow. So, yeah, like so back, you knew there was back still in 5 minutes.
Back in 5 minutes, exactly.
Yeah. And they still use that today for mourning. So if someone dies, like when the Queen died, then all Dutch windmills were in that position, right? It's like us having flags at half mast. Yeah, all windmills go to mourning windmill position, which is like the crucifix position as opposed to the X marks the spot position.
That is amazing.
Yeah, it's cool.
And incorrect. Oh. So what you would do is... it was at more of a diagonal direction that you would have it. That would be the morning to suggest that there was a death. Yeah, there's. I can just go show you a little photo here.
He's absolutely right. I was just testing you, Dan, and you have learned the windmill language correctly. Well done.
Thank you. And then if you were 12 o'clock and you went to say, like, you're on your way to 1 o'clock, it's like half 12, the small hands on its way, that is celebration. We've had a baby. And so you would know, you would see the windmill and go, oh my God, they've had another baby.
But when it's actually working, do you think, baby morning, baby morning, baby morning?
Picking your moment when to go into the house, through the door, and not be decapitated. But yeah, so isn't that cool? It had its own language as well.
Very cool. And they go backwards.
Do they?
Yeah. Dutch windmills go round the wrong way. Or, they would see, the right way. counterclockwise, whereas all windmills that are built in the modern day go around clockwise. And
we know why.
Well, it's kind of arbitrary and not a good thing. So it's basically because in the 70s, when everyone was getting the big windmill contracts, there was an engineer called Leif Nielsen, a Danish engineer, and he had a brother working at a rival windmill company, and his brother was going for the standard counterclockwise direction, and he didn't like his brother much, so said, okay, I'm going to make my turbines go around clockwise. And then he got all the contracts, and that's why all windmills go around clockwise
today.
You're
joking. This is like Aldi Lidl
It's all over again.
All over again.
Yeah, yeah. And it's actually the worst way for them to go round in the Northern Hemisphere.
How can it be worse?
There was a study done which showed it actually can generate 30% more energy if they go backwards / anti-clockwise because of the Coriolis effect in the Northern Hemisphere, which sends the little whirlwinds of air that the turbines generate in the opposite direction. It generates more energy.
Why didn't they just put them the other way around?
What, you mean, why don't they spin them the other way around?
No, just put them facing the other way, then they'll go backwards, right?
I'll put you in touch.
Why do I have to do all the work?
I read also that a windmill can never give you more than 16/27 of the energy of the wind.
Okay.
This is something called Betz's limit, and I'd love to tell you more about it, but literally someone sent us that fact 2 minutes before we came on stage, so I didn't really have a chance to read up on it. But I think it's because basically the energy of the wind has to go through the sails. So if it got 100% of the energy onto it, it would just stop there, but they wouldn't spin round. So the air has to go through them, I think.
Okay.
From a 1 minute reading of a Wikipedia page.
Well,
but thank you to whoever sent that in.
Here's a cool thing. First windmill that generated electricity, first turbine, created by James Blythe, who was a professor at Glasgow College. It was 10 meters high. It was tiny. I mean, he used it to charge some batteries, and at the time, batteries were incredibly primitive as well. But two nice things about that. Villagers nearby thought this is the work of the devil, and they refused to sign off on it. That's not one of the nice things. It could light up 10 light bulbs. That's not one of the nice things either. That's just an example of what size this was. I'm struggling to find the nice things about this now. The nice things are, he's got the National Wind Turbine Testing Facility named after him now. Uh-huh. He's a big deal in the wind world.
That's nice.
And that's where they test them to the absolute maximum. They sort of put them through unbelievable stress until they snap. And when they snap, you can feel an earthquake 500 meters away because these blades are so huge. The tips are going around at 200 miles an hour.
Whoa!
It's incredible. It's so good.
And then they snap and you have to build a whole new one. Send that to the testing facility. Snaps, build a new one. How do they ever get made?
I know. But that's science for you, isn't it? But no, the other thing is, the first ever wind-powered home was in 1887. And that means that, you know, Jack the Ripper could have seen a wind turbine.
Oh, that's nice.
Sorry, that's the nice thing.
Yeah.
Or pick your person who was alive in 1887.
Just anyone else. Queen Victoria.
Oscar Wilde.
All good examples. Did someone say Gandhi? Gandhi would have been very young.
Very young.
But he would have been alive. Good point. Touché. No, but hang on. I'm sorry to quibble, but you need someone who... Because Gandhi could have seen a wind turbine later on, you know, for the rest of his life. I mean, in the 30s or 40s, he could have seen the one at Grandpa's Knob. What we're looking for, ideally, is the most famous person who died in late 1887.
And ideally one who didn't murder lots of people.
Ideally not Jack the Ripper. No, Gandhi is a great point. Thank you. So are we all clear on who could and couldn't see a wind turbine?
Oh, good. That's what this room was all about. Scientific debate and...
At Market District, we believe in the power of great taste, like juicy heirloom tomatoes, cheesy house-made pizza, and fresh artisan-made bread. From produce to meats to chef-made meals, discover great taste at Market District.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everyone. We'd like to let you know that this week we are sponsored by Babbel.
That's right. Babbel, the most important language learning tool that you can get. And I'll tell you why, James. Between 70 and 90% of people who try to learn a new language just give up. And it's true. I've tried to relearn languages that I had a basic knowledge of in school, and you just give up after 2 weeks. Babbel is designed to make sure that you enjoy it and you want to learn more.
Yeah, like the language of Atlantis. I remember you tried to speak that for a little while.
Yeah, it's really hard, actually, and there's not many people to chat with.
Well, the great thing about Babbel is, okay, they don't do the language of Atlantis, but they do so many different languages. Pretty much any language you can think of, they will be there. And their courses are designed by over 200 language experts, real human beings, not fish people. And they can teach you the relevant words and phrases that you will actually use so you can start speaking with confidence in as little as 3 weeks. We have all tried using Babbel over the years. I know Andy definitely is is using it right now to polish up on his German. And we have a special limited time deal for our listeners, don't we, Dan?
That's right. You can get up to 60% off on your Babbel subscription if you go to babbel.com/fish.
That's right. So get 60% off babbel.com/fish. That's babbel.com/fish. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Flatterbladian frakotugel, which is on with the podcast in Atlantean.
On with the podcast in English.
Okay, it is time for fact number two, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that when he was a child, notable Royal Institution lecturer Humphrey Davy's favorite hobby was to lock himself in his room and give hour-long talks to a bunch of empty chairs. This is Humphrey Davy, who is one of the most spectacular names ever to have walked into this building, an absolute juggernaut of science. We're going to talk about him in a second, but one of the things he was notable for outside of his discoveries was he was an astonishing lecturer. He delivered the most amazing lectures, and it turns out not only did he have an amazing love of science from childhood, but he also just he loved having a crowd of people listen to him, and he didn't even need the crowd. He just needed the idea of a crowd. So when he was a child, he used to go out and he used to gather kids at the local market, and he would just rant at them based on anything that he found interesting,
It's really sweet.
And then back at home, he would set up those chairs. Yeah.
Forcing children to gather at the market while you scream about, you know, electricity to them.
It sounds like he's a child.
He's a child too.
Oh, okay. No, that is better.
Yeah. Yeah. But he was a science-minded child, and he was always in chemicals. He was obsessed with them, and he used to do tricks on his family. So for his sisters, he used to take chemicals that would be phosphorescent, and at night, when they turned the when it got dark, suddenly these monsters were on their bedroom wall that he'd painted on. Cool. So he played lots of tricks with the chemicals even as a child.
That's cool. And then he kind of went into poetry, didn't he? He really loved poetry when he was a young man.
Yeah.
And he even had some poems published by Robert Southey.
Southey.
But then what seems to have happened, because he's from Cornwall, there was a big shipwreck. And on that shipwreck, there was loads of instruments from French surgeons and stuff. And then he managed to get all of these instruments and then started doing loads of experiments and then got into science afterwards. But he was into science, but this is where he started to do all of
this. Gosh, that's very romantic. Because he was was it Penzance, I think? He's a very proud son of Cornwall and all this. So he went to Bristol, first of all, to start his career. And this was the really first really exciting thing. At the age of 20, he was in Bristol working for someone called Thomas Beddoes. And he was working on laughing gas, and he was just the sort of young man in the room who was to a certain extent a guinea pig. He was really interested in science, but
that is the best job ever, though, isn't it? When all your friends are interning at their dad's printing company, you're the guinea pig for laughing gas.
Yeah, and he really got into it. I mean, he took a lot of laughing gas for a long time, and that was the time when he knew all these poets. So he knew Southey, he knew Samuel Taylor Coleridge. This is all in Bristol. He was friends with Roger of thesaurus fame?
Yes.
Wow.
I know.
Do you know what? I read Roger's account of taking laughing gas, because what Humphrey Davy did was he said, you can come to all these laughing gas parties I'm throwing, but you have to write down notes of exactly how you found it. Uh-huh. And so he compiled this book of all their notes. And Roger...
It sounds dreadful. It sounds like a load of people's anecdotes about getting stoned. As in, it sounds
it's
like
brilliant. I've read it.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Okay, of course. Oh, well, maybe it's more up my street than yours, because it is just what you described.
Yeah, okay.
But I suppose it's not like your mates telling you. It's like the greatest poets of the 19th century.
Yeah.
I still think drug experiences and dreams are the two things that are terrific in your own head and then kind of...
No, it's the original... Davy's the original Aldous Huxley, Doors of Perception. That's what he was doing. He was trying to show that your brain went into a different state of consciousness when you were on these things and what you were opening yourself up to. That's the bit I can see, just Anna, you didn't
to be
like.
Honest, that is the most tedious thing about people who've taken drugs is when they talk about the altered states of consciousness. I just want to hear that they sort of shat themselves in a corner at their grandma's house.
If it's that, then fine. Yeah,
that's true, yeah.
Which is, and Roger of Thesaurus fame, his account, well, here's what it is. He said, I was incapable of speaking, lost all consciousness of where I was. My whole frame was violently agitated. I panted violently and my heart seemed to palpitate and every artery to throb with violence. Of thesaurus fame. He uses the word violent about 19 times in his account.
So good.
He hated it. Most of them loved it. He said, I cannot remember that I experienced the least pleasure from these sensations.
Really?
Wow. Yeah.
Because okay. Coleridge loved it.
Yeah.
Davey really loved it. Like, they got to a point where the party died down and no one wanted to do it anymore, but he just kept doing it. And he went around with a sort of green silk bag that he would just fill up with the stuff, and he would go for long walks, and he would do it to the point where he'd pass out and wake up 2 hours later, not realizing how much he had done, and then get back on the horse and do it some more.
But everyone's got that friend from uni, haven't they? Sort of 10 years later, oh, you're still...
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
He did move on. He moved to London, and he came to the Royal Institution and invented the miner's safety lamp, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
But yeah, he did loads of lectures in this very room, didn't he? And they were so popular that the traffic around here got really, really busy, and they made a one-way street so that people could get in and out, and it was the first one-way street in the whole of England.
Yeah, the Royal Institution is on Albemarle Street, which is just outside us, and so many people were coming horse and carriage and walking and crowding to see Davy speak that they had to change the whole system so that they could just stop London coming to a standstill.
Which is actually a huge faff when you're cycling here on the way to a show and you're late. So good to know I have him to blame for my near-death experience today.
He discovered five elements, which he showed at the Royal Institution for the first time. So calcium.
Biggie.
Strontium.
Yes, yeah, like
B-side, yeah.
Yeah. Barium.
Barium.
Okay.
Unless it was named after a guy called Barry.
Yeah.
Boron.
Yeah.
Magnesium.
Biggie.
Yeah. These are huge. But he said his greatest discovery of all was not a chemical, it was not any of the experiments, it was a little student called Michael Faraday. And Michael Faraday is also one of the great...
good noise.
Not many rooms you'd get that noise in when you drop Faraday's name. Faraday had come to a bunch of lectures that he'd seen Davy do when he was younger, and he scribbled down this big booklet of ideas and so on, and he sent it to Davy. And Davy saw so much potential that he brought him in. But Faraday is also one of the great giants of this room.
Yeah. Didn't Davy have a big accident or something? He was working with nitrogen trichloride, which is a huge explosive, and it exploded in his face. And he went partially blind for quite a long time, and he needed a helper. And that's when he brought Faraday in to help him. So this one big accident was what brought them together to work together, and what really gave us Faraday.
He was reckless, I would say. He used to shut himself in a box with the gases he was inhaling to make sure he got the most intense high possible. And there was one time when he sent all of his servants away because he really just wanted to, you know, if you're having a big high, you want to enjoy it by yourself, alone. And one of his servants didn't get, I'm told, one of his servants didn't get the memo, didn't realize that they'd all been dismissed. And so he came to see if Humphrey wanted, you know, a cigar or something. Came in, found him in this, you know, shut box that Humphrey'd built for himself specifically, completely unconscious, asphyxiating, and dragged him out. And he would have died had this servant not rescued him. So he did take self-experimentation to, someone say, quite stupid limits.
But can we say the thing about the safety lamp, where he saved a lot of lives?
Yeah.
This is incredible. So miners were dying by the dozen, and in fact, many more than that, due to something called fire damp, which we would call methane, where you have these pockets of methane underground that catch fire, and the only way of lighting your mine underground is with candles. So this is a huge problem. And he spent, I think it was about 2 weeks on the problem before designing a lamp. And there is a bit of debate about whether there was a different kind of lamp. Stevenson of Rocket fame came up with another version of one, but this, I mean, from what it looks like, this definitely was Davy's invention, and it's basically just a fine sort of cylinder of gauze around the light that you're using.
It kind of encloses the light, doesn't it?
Yeah, you still get the light, but you don't get the methane exploding, even if you're in a dangerous area.
Yeah.
And he refused to patent it, which was very exciting, and I think for over a century, coal miners carried these things and did not die due to that, at least due to methane. They died of plenty of other things. Yeah. But it was, and what this did was it made deeper and bigger seams of coal accessible. And a lot of the Industrial Revolution was powered by miners being able to access lots more coal. So, you know, that huge change in the world was at least partly thanks to Davy's lamp.
But did any of you think that it's quite basic? It's literally all he does is put, it's like you put a sieve over a candle. That's all it is. Miners are going into mines, candles are causing explosions. And David says, you know what, if you put a sieve over this, a metal gauze, because it's metal, it absorbs all the heat. So you don't have the heat for that big explosion. And that's it. Put a sieve over it.
So the best ideas do seem simple once they've been discovered, right?
I just reckon I would have come up with that in my kitchen at some point. I'm not...
Are you sure?
I can't be 100%, but... But
I just think, yeah, combining it with any utensil in your house, I wouldn't think of the sieve, first of all.
Had we invented the sieve at this point?
Yeah, the sieve was... Ooh.
Oh,
no,
my God.
No, he didn't invent the sieve because then the headline would have been Sieve Man.
Sieve Man, it does.
Sieve Man helps with coal mine stuff.
So when was the sieve around?
When was the sieve?
Who came first, Gandhi or the sieve? That's what I want to know.
No one knows.
No one knows.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can we talk about his wife as well?
Yeah, of course.
So he married a very wealthy heiress, which is the done thing at the time, Jane Aprees, and she is responsible for a very interesting bit of his story because... He went on a very dangerous journey in 1813. So what's going on in 1813?
Probably fighting the French, I
fighting
think.
The French. Fighting the French.
You said that a little bit too enthusiastic.
I'm up for it. I will serve, if called.
But only if it was the French.
If it's the French, I'm not. Yeah, just to limit it. Yeah. So there was a thing called the Prix du Galvanisme, created in 1801 by Napoleon Bonaparte, which was a prize for, you know, scientific advances. He had won it, and in 1813, so really, you know, like Napoleon's march on Moscow has just ended catastrophically. We're gearing up for Waterloo. It's a great time. Davy and his wife Jane Aprees and Faraday went to Brittany to present themselves to Napoleon to pick up the medal and the check. They were arrested mistakenly when they got there. So this was quite a perilous trip they made, but they did make it, got the gong and the money and all of that. But there was a really big appeal a few years ago by the Royal Society of Chemistry saying, where is this medal? And it turned out that Jane, his widow, had been so embarrassed to have this French medal and the French money in the house that she had hurled it into the sea off the Cornish coast after he died. They knew roughly where they had done it, and they spent 4 days diving in, I think it was 2013 they did this.
Really?
Or 2014. Yeah, they didn't find it, obviously, because, you know, it's very hard to find. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
they
but
did look. They
so
did
it
look.
Still might be out there. There still might be...
It's still definitely out there.
Wow, the Davy treasure. That's cool.
Yeah. Find very it. Exciting. Go and find it.
He actually was very much against the French, though, wasn't he, Davy? I think.
Good lad.
He went.
Sorry.
I'll tell you what. You know what? Over the last 2 or 3 weeks, we've been talking about football every single day, and Andy has not been interested until we said that we beat France.
Excited.
But no, he went to the Louvre, and then he wrote back to his friend saying, "Yeah, it's all right. It's just full of stuff that Napoleon stole, isn't it?"
Right.
Yeah.
He went to. There was an anti-British play on at the time, and he went and sort of sat in the back and watched to see what they were saying about us. And the main thing was there's another chemist called Lavoisier, and Lavoisier had done all this stuff about the science of heat, and Davy disagreed with Lavoisier's theories, and in the end he managed to prove it. And when he proved it in his paper, he was just all about how the French were so dogmatic about their ideas and how we've finally proven them wrong. And so, yeah, he was just like he was like the Andrew Hunter Murray of his day.
Okay, it is time for fact number three, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that it's not as foggy as it used to be.
Is this a fact or a conversation opener?
It's such a boomer opinion to have. I'm not saying you're a boomer, I'm just saying.
Do you think?
Oh yeah, that's got Daily Express article written all over it. Like, what's wrong with a bit of good old British fog? You know,
and it's the immigrants' fault.
Yes, right.
And you know what? The young people couldn't handle it anyway.
I don't think it would be in the Express because it's probably due to climate change.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, this is quite a few studies that have been done over the last few years, and every single one shows a big decrease in fog. 2009 study showed that in Europe there is a 50% drop in low visibility events, which just is fog, mist, haze, all of that stuff, since the 1970s. And in 2010, the Berkeley University looked at America and they found that fog has declined 33% since 1951. And what it seems is that basically climate change means that as the oceans warm, the conditions you need for sea fog, especially. You need like a cold water surface in order for the fog to form, because it's when the warm air from the water kind of hits the land. You just don't really get those conditions anymore. So we just get less fog than we used to. And it's important. Fog is the new moss.
I'm in.
Fog is really important. So there's lots of crops which use fog in places where it doesn't rain so much. For instance, in California, where they make lots of lettuce or they make lots of strawberries, it's the fog which nourishes them and keeps them hydrated. And in cities, the fog can sort of move away pollutants from the air. So it's really useful there as well. We need our fog, and it's all going.
Wow. Bring back the fog.
It's really important as well for London tourism. As early as the 1970s, the tourist board would urge Americans to come to England and to London in particular when it was winter, so that it would be at its foggiest, because Americans love foggy London.
Americans, write in if you agree with this.
It might have changed recently, but it certainly was. And there were massive...
Probably changed a bit recently.
So don't ask anyone. Don't ask anyone. Just believe me.
I see that. Like, if you're American, you come to London and you want to see the London of Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
Or the London of Humphrey Davy, is going to be like that kind of...
You know who else loved a bit of London fog? Jack the Ripper.
Keen, very keen. But like, there was a company in America that did coats, still do coats. I think they were called London Town initially. They changed their name to London Fog.
But I think that's because it was famous back in the day. I mean, by the 70s, it was gone. Yeah. We'd nailed it. This was a big smog, wasn't it? That was, yeah, Victorian era, start of the 20th century, bit of a disaster in London. No one could see anything. Americans flocked because, you know, Thomas Cook organized fog holidays, apparently. But aside from that, it was quite bad. And then we had the Clean Air Act in 1956,
yeah,
which is kind of an amazing success story, which basically sorted it out. But it was a massive issue before that. And it was particularly an issue for Hollywood, in fact, and for filmmakers. So it wasn't just bad for filming outdoors. It would get inside film studios in London because there was so much of it. And they didn't know how to get rid of it. So some films in the 1920s that were shot in London had to shoot at night because, you know, you can penetrate darkness with a light, but you can't penetrate it. As anyone who's ever tried to turn on fog lights knows, when they do fuck all, anyone knows that you can't penetrate fog with any light. So if you wanted to film something... then you had to film it at night. So film schedules would be from 9 p.m. until 6 a.m.
Oh my God.
It was so mad.
Alfred Hitchcock's first ever full-length film was called The Lodger, A Story of the London Fog.
Oh.
It was a big bit of brand Britain. Certainly, yeah. London, actually. And, you know, any other big industrial cities. Because I think we might have mentioned before that London particular was a term for the fog. But there was also the Manchester entire. You know, where you just couldn't see anything in Manchester.
Oh, Andy Burnham. Stop trying to make it happen.
It is incredible reading about it now, like just how thick the air was. So in 1901, not far from here in Piccadilly Circus, they needed to turn the lights on in Piccadilly, even though the sun was shining and it was daytime. Mm. It was so foggy, you couldn't see where you were going. You couldn't see to drive around. Sometimes you would be standing by the window during the day and you couldn't read a book. I mean, it was so foggy. It was coal, basically. Every home was heated by coal. There were big coal power plants in the center of town. It was coal, coal, coal. But the cool thing was, fog changed color. You could tell what time of day it was by the color of the fog.
Really?
Yeah. So yellow in the morning, because people are burning coal to heat their homes and all of this, and the tar in particular made it yellow. Later in the day, when the industries got going, trains and ships, it would turn dark brown.
None of these are nice colors.
No, they're not. Okay, well, there were green fogs, purple fogs, black fogs, but it was just such a mega
That's
thing.
So
and how precise was this? Because you say to someone, I'll meet you at yellow o'clock.
Yeah, definitely.
And yeah. Half past purple.
Sadly, you can't see where the fuck you're going, but... Is this more smog than fog? I thought fog was just water, pure fog.
I think so, proper yeah. Fog. This was smog for sure.
It was combined, wasn't it?
It's like fog.
Foggy and then yeah. With a lot of pollution.
You do get super fog. Which is even foggier than normal fog, and even foggier than smog.
Really?
It happens if there's like forest fires and stuff, because water vapor condenses onto the smoke particles. And so the reason that Anna's fog lights don't work is because the light goes in, but then it's dissipated by all the tiny little water particles. But in the super fog, it dissipates it even more, and so you literally can't see anything. You're driving along, there's a little bit of fog, and then suddenly it just goes dark, completely black. You can't see a single thing, and loads of accidents because of that.
Gosh.
Oh, wow. Super black fog.
So you were pro-fog before, but now we're...
I think fog is, it's got many facets. Mm. It's like, there's lots of advantages to it. So I said before that it can clean the cities. It turns out the fog is alive. And yes. It is.
So in what way?
So there's bacteria in the fog. And if you take a thimbleful of fog water, it has about 10 million bacteria, which is the same as if you took the average bit of seawater. So it's all really dissipated. Yeah, it's all really dissipated, but the actual amount of bacteria in there is the same. And this bacteria, they eat the chemicals, things like formaldehyde, which is in the air, which is very bad for you. The bacteria can eat that and turn it into things that aren't bad for you. So that's why they get rid of all of these chemicals from our air.
Right.
Okay.
You get things like fog catchers now. Humans, like the crocodile hunter, you get fog hunter. So there's a guy called Abel Cruz, and in Peru, Bolivia, and so on, where they don't have necessarily access to clean water, he's worked a system of nets that are up at night, and they collect the fog water as it's coming through. That's how a lot of places are now getting their drinking water.
Although they seem to have had trouble scaling it up. I couldn't find anywhere that's really done it on a big scale. And so the only useful version I found of fog catchers was in San Francisco, where in 2016 they worked out how to turn fog into vodka, which you can buy. And this is a project of a non-profit, actually, which claims to be trying to provide water to developing countries, but took some time out to collect fog in San Francisco with, it looks like two goalposts with a net in between, catches the fog and then collects them and then turns it into water. And the fog catcher on that project was called Chris Fogliati.
Oh, come on.
Why would there be an international agreement on what fog is? There's an international definition of fog.
Okay, why do we have that? Mm. Something else has to be standardized, which fog is important for. So it's the strength of your fog lights in your car, so they're the same in every car in the world.
To do with transport.
Is it to do with shipping?
It's not to do with shipping.
Oh. It's to do with airplanes.
It's to do with airplanes.
Okay.
Oh, so when you're allowed to fly versus not.
Because when you're allowed to fly.
Ah, God damn it.
So that's just for aviation.
You just got to wait at the back, James, and let everyone do the work.
But there is this tool. So basically, yeah, that's it. Just if it's foggy, you know, you can't land safely on a runway. I mean, they've got some tools to deal with it now. But there was a great tool invented way back when. I think this might have been before the Second World War, called the Fog Investigation and Dispersal Operation, FIDO for short. And it was designed to just clear fog off airfields so that planes could land safely.
Wow.
And it's basically two pipelines going along the runway, and you just produce a wall of flame. Like, oh,
cool.
It is quite rock and roll. And it's just the standard FIDO system apparently used 100,000 gallons of fuel every hour. So it's
wow,
a bit of a luxury. It's a bit of a treat, more if it's a long runway. But the amount of money it saved by having a plane not crashing into the ground was probably, you know, made it useful for a while.
Yeah. So that's what's reassuring as a pilot. If you're flying towards the runway and there's a huge wall of fire in front of you, you know you're good to go.
Yeah.
It did decide a crucial thing in the 15th century. And I think you might have had an opinion about this, James, because it was in the Wars of the Roses and it cemented a Yorkist victory. It was one of the most important victories. It was the Battle of Barnet.
I've gone off fog a little bit.
I thought you might. This was Battle of Barnet, and it was King Edward IV of York versus Earl of Warwick, who was Lancastrian, and there was very thick fog, and this screwed things up in various ways. One of the ways was the armies didn't line up right against each other, which I find kind of amazing anyway, that you'd like organize at the start of battle and be like, okay, your furthest left man has to be exactly opposite our furthest right guy, and they weren't lined up. This meant when they charged towards each other, one side of the army totally surrounded the other and were like, oh my God, we're winning this. But the other side of that army totally surrounded them and thought, oh my God, we're winning this. And because it's foggy, they can't see the other side of their line. So they don't know they're losing on the other side.
This is like a do-si-do, isn't it?
It was very much the country dancing of the 1400s, yes.
So what happened?
What is war but a ceilidh? So eventually this, it was all chaos for a long time. And then eventually at one point, one of the sides, I think it was Warwick's side, sort of went off the battlefield and tried to regroup. The problem was they had in their heraldry a picture of stars and streamers, and King Edward had a sun in sort of splendor, and they look in very thick fog, very similar. And so Warwick's men all started firing on themselves and killed each other without Edward really having to do anything. And then there we go. And that led to the Yorkists being in charge for a decade or two. So there you go, fog is your enemy, James.
Wow. We should move on, guys, to our final facts.
I got one more thing about climate change and things that are changing. So Snowshoe hares, they have a little trick. So in the winter, they're white, and in the spring, they turn brown.
Brilliant.
It's for camouflage, obviously, so they can camouflage in the snow. Unfortunately, due to climate change, the snow is not around as long as it used to be. And so for a certain amount of the year, they're bright white, but there's no snow to camouflage. And the guy who has read an article about a guy called Alex Kumar says that they act like you can't see them. So they're stood there and they're thinking, nah, nah, you can't see me. But actually everyone can see exactly what's happening.
Wow, they are not long for this world. If you want to see them, get there fast.
That's like my three-year-old playing hide and seek when you walk in the room and they're hiding behind a lamp that's just literally holding it.
At Giant Eagle, we believe in better. And that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.
Okay, it's time for our final fact of the show, and that is Anna.
My fact this week is that in 2024, Google was fined more than the world's total GDP. A lot more.
Good.
In fact, yeah.
Do it again.
You want them to double it?
Yes.
Okay, right.
Well, no. They are doubling it.
Are they?
They are indeed. Yes. Yes. So this is a Russian court which fined Google 2 undecillion rubles. Which is a 2 followed by 36 zeros, as I'm sure you know. It's 20 decillion US dollars, if you're interested. And it's for restricting Russian state media channels on Google services.
Still think it's good, Andy?
I've changed my opinion a bit. I did read an article about it saying it's 20 decillion dollars, brackets 15.4 decillion pounds.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Imagine being sued for amounts you've never heard of before.
Yeah, it doesn't feel good.
I didn't
know
decillion existed.
There was a guy from the Kremlin, Dmitry Peskov, who said, I cannot even pronounce this number, which is weird because the Russian for undecillion is undecillion.
Oh, okay. So I believe it's more dollars than there are grains of sand on Earth.
Yes.
Really?
And the article that Anna sent round said that it was whatever undecillion it was, but it was doubling every single day.
Yeah, so it's way more now. I mean,
it's way more now. According to my calculation, this was when I did it a few days ago, so it's doubled a few times since then. The current fine is 2 × 10^225 rubles.
Oh, no.
So if you were to take every atom in the universe and every single atom had another universe in it, and every single atom in that universe had another universe attached to it, then the total number of atoms that you have will be nowhere near this number.
And that's why you've got to pay in the first 14 days. Wow.
So are they going to do like a payment plan? What's the...
It's hard to know. I think they have to earn over a certain amount in their salary before they start.
Yes. I think they just wait until the ruble collapses by so much that it's actually just about 20 quid.
Yeah.
It did start off much more reasonable, as you say. It started off as 91.5 quintillion rubles.
Was it for something? Sorry.
According to Russia, they were deliberately not allowing people to see Russian news on Google searches.
Okay. Yeah, so it's barring a lot of Russian sites because it was coinciding with the war in Ukraine and Google saying that there's a lot of misinformation out there that it was blocking because Google doesn't like misinformation to spread. And Google subsidiary has gone bankrupt in Russia as a result of all these massive debts that they're being asked to pay. And they've got quite basic functionality there, but I don't think the Kremlin really minds. So we're at a bit of a stalemate.
So does it do fines work is the question?
It feels like at that level, you're starting to not work, doesn't it? But they certainly have worked with the EU and tech companies. In fact, do you know who has been the only sort of barrier between tech companies and going completely insane and doing whatever the hell they want? I'm going to say it's a single person. This is my claim.
It's not Nick Clegg.
It's Cleggy. No, he's got nothing to do with it. It's Borgen. Borgen, do you guys know the TV show Borgen?
Danish detective? Or Danish Prime Minister?
Danish Prime Minister. But yeah, Borgen has been holding back Google. And
in
this
what
is,
way?
Well, because the character in it, who's Birgit Nyborg, who is the Prime Minister, is based on this woman called Marguerite Vestager. And she was EU's antitrust chief from 2014 to 2024. And she was the person who basically led the charge preventing tech monopolies. So as soon as there was any kind of like online rigging that Google was doing to rig things in its favor, as soon as there's any anti-competitive stuff, she brought lawsuits against them, against Google, Apple, Amazon, X, Starbucks, IKEA, Gazprom. I feel like IKEA's kind of the good guy in there, actually. But it's made a huge difference to them, just this woman and a large team of people also in the EU.
Yeah.
But leading the charge.
That's cool.
Wow.
There you go. And Prime Minister of a fictional country at the same time. So
that's very cool. You asked whether fines work, Andy. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, I think is the answer. If you fine people for being late, let's say, for instance, you are late picking your child up from the nursery, and it means that the teachers have to stay a little bit longer, everyone's a little bit annoyed, so you get told off. Or they change it, so you don't get told off anymore, but you get a fine. It turns out people are way more likely to accept the fine and then just be late anyway. And the reason is they kind of see it as an exchange of money for time.
Yeah.
And people think, well, you know what? I'm paying a little bit of a fine, so it's actually no problem if I'm late, because at least I'm paying.
I'm buying the right to be a bit late.
Exactly.
And then you're not allowed to be cross with me because you're fining me.
That's the idea.
And people are more unhappy about someone very cross from the nursery.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Especially because I've told you, you can just tie her to the railing outside and leave her there.
As long as she has a little bowl of water that she can lick from. Yeah.
I've got a show to do in London.
Wow. So this is the really interesting thing. Yes, there have been lots of studies of whether fines have any power. Yeah. And it's because, you know, you need to calculate the cross-section between the chance of being caught and how severe the punishment is if you are caught. And lots of firms, especially the huge firms, treat it as the cost of doing business. You know, well, we may as well, we know that they won't fine us much more than this, even if we are caught. Therefore, there's no real incentive to change.
Yeah.
So I think unpredictable fines are maybe the way to go.
Oh, yeah. So I'm caught speeding.
Yeah.
And I get the letter through the post.
£2 million fine.
Oh. I was hoping it was going to be 10p.
Yeah. Well, Noel Edmonds picked it out of the box. And it's like, I think there would be a case to be made for chaos fines where it could go really badly.
What's the country where the fine is?
There are a couple. There's Switzerland and Finland, I think, are two of the ones that do it.
You mean proportional
to your income, yeah.
Proportional to your income. And also they increase it based on various other fun factors, so you get to kind of spin the wheel. Have you been fined before recently? Bigger fine. Do you earn a lot of money? Bigger fine. So I think the biggest fine ever was a Swiss driver. This was a couple of years ago. And he was caught going at 290 kilometers an hour. So actually not that much in miles an hour. But
was he going directly off one of the mountains?
I think he got done for just over 1 million euros.
Yeah,
that's right.
It was.
Exactly. Yeah. Did he do it again? Don't know, but it doesn't matter. We've got €1 million now with the Swiss government.
Yeah.
So I think that is a good case to be made for that.
Yeah. There was a guy in Finland, the other place that does it, a guy in 2023 called Anders Wickloff, who was only driving at 51 miles an hour. So it does feel like this guy driving at 180 miles an hour has done a big one.
What's the limit, though?
This guy,
who was going at 290 kilometres an hour, he was actually in a 280 zone. So he was only...
Yeah, you're right.
Right.
this was obviously in like a 31 mile an hour speed limit, okay. Converted to kilometres an hour. He was fined €121,000. He'd been fined before in 2018, he'd been fined €63,000, and he'd been fined €95,000 in 2013. And he was asked in 2023, you know, how he felt about this 121 grand he'd lost again. And he said, look, I've heard the government wants to save some money on healthcare, so I hope my money can help fill a gap.
Okay. Oh,
there yeah. you go. Isn't that nice?
That's good. Yeah, I mean, you do read about some fines that I do think, like James is saying, oh, yeah, it's worth it. It's worth it to pay it. I was reading a story about a guy in Portsmouth who went around Portsmouth Cemetery with his arms in the air pretending to be a ghost, going, woo-woo-woo. And he got fined £75.
Why?
He was doing it while people were mourning.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. There's my context. I'm not a monster. That's, yeah. But a fine feels a bit...
Yeah.
Well, what would you do?
Well, right, I'd say a letter of apology.
Okay.
I think that's a good letter of apology is another good one, you know.
Okay.
For grown-ups.
Yeah, for grown-ups.
Right, okay.
Everyone's busy. No one's got time to write a bloody letter. It's a huge pain in the ass.
I suppose whether it's a bank transfer is just click of a button and you're there.
Exactly.
Okay.
Having to write two sides. You're not allowed to do double spacing either. Suddenly, people are thinking before they get the sheet on and run around Portsmouth Cemetery.
But you could use up a lot of the space on the page by saying, I'm sorry I said, woo.
That's a good point.
So how much was this guy fined?
£75.
Okay, more or less for this fine. Roy Marsh was sitting by a boating lake in Lincolnshire when a gust of wind blew a bit of grass into his mouth and he spat it out, and two enforcement officers immediately approached him and told him they'd seen him spitting on the ground. More or less than 75 quid.
Oh, I think a fine for spitting. Oh, this is...
Oh, nice.
Wow.
James, this is your Brucey moment.
I think we've got something here, haven't
this
we?
This is a format.
Yeah, yeah.
So the room is saying more?
I think more. Yeah, more.
We all
more.
Think more. Okay, the answer is more.
Hey.
£300.
300?
Yeah.
Wow, they didn't think it was that much.
Sorry, did someone say more after?
Okay, more or less than £300. A Florida priest was fined for feeding the homeless. They're just baying for blood here. Yeah,
it sounds punitive, the way you guys are screaming it. Yeah.
So they're saying more in the room.
Less, I'll go less.
I'll say more.
This one.
More. Okay, so you said more. It is more. But I'll just to make it sort of still a bit of a competition, how much more?
£2 million.
Ah, good. Like 50 quid more.
Dan is just closer.
Oh!
Because he was fined more than $500,000.
Wow.
Because a bit like this Russian fine, it kind of just went up and up and up, and he was doing it every single day for quite a few years.
Why was it not allowed?
It was in an area that was not where his church was. And the annoying thing was, it's the area where his church used to be, and then it got rezoned, and he carried on feeding the people in that zone, and they said, you're not allowed to do it, and he got fined for every single day that he did it, and it racked up to $500,000.
Where's this? Where do you get fined for feeding homeless people?
This was in Florida.
Wow.
Wow.
Everyone's going, yeah, that checks out. Okay.
That's amazing. Do you know Freddie Flintoff, when he was an England cricketer, he once got fined £2,000 because he was scared by a ghost. And
was he in Portsmouth Cemetery at the time?
Yeah.
Because Portsmouth Council, they're cleaning up here.
They really are.
Both ends of the transaction.
No, he was in... He was in Zimbabwe at the time. They were playing a game overseas, and Mal Loy, is that his name? Do you know him, James? He starts telling ghost stories, and Freddie gets freaked out because he doesn't like ghosts. And so he runs off to his friend's room, who's called Vikram. Vikram's very religious, and the logic was that maybe ghosts won't go near him because he's very religious.
Sure.
So then he couldn't go to sleep. Both of them were freaked out. They then sleep in and they're late for practice. And so they get fined £2,000 because they were late for practice, all because this ghost was freaking them out. But according to Freddie, Mal got in trouble as well and fined for telling a ghost story that scared Freddie.
Yeah, that's unfair.
So you don't tell ghost stories to our key player who's terrified of them, you dick?
I can, knowing Freddie Flintoff, I can imagine the worst spirits involved somewhere.
We got to wrap up very soon.
Can I briefly talk about the greatest fining nation in Europe?
Sure.
Hmm? I hate to give it to them. It's the French. They are so good at fining you for minor social infractions. It's unbelievable. So there's all sorts of people, especially on the French trains. They have very strict rules and they have lots of enforcement people. So there have been French pilgrims who were fined by police for doing some chanting in Latin at a station, having been to a cathedral. There was a middle-aged man who was fined 200 euros quite recently for just having a call on loudspeaker in a train station, not even on a train. More! Okay, okay. This is how the revolution started, guys, all right? It's not petty. And five officers approached him, and they said they'd... Okay. People just want social norms observed, and quite right. There was... Okay, we'll see what you think of this one, guys.
Oh, my God.
There's a French woman was fined 110... But you have to wait, okay? There was a French woman who was fined 110 euros because her cat meowed too loudly on a high-speed train, despite the fact the cat had a ticket.
That's it. That is all of our facts. Thank you for being here, everyone, in this amazing room. And we're going to be back again next week with more No Such Thing as a Fish from the Royal Institution. So we'll see you again. Goodbye, everyone.
Giant Eagle, we believe in better. And that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9th, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.